This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West here on RN and the ABC Listen app. A free speech controversy erupts at a US university. Can you ever display an image of the Prophet Muhammad?
I teach these images of Muhammad regularly, and in fact, I teach a full PhD seminar, which lasts an entire semester, on Islamic images of the Prophet Muhammad. So I've trained PhD students in this material, and I never include trigger warnings or content warnings or the option to bow out.
That's coming up. The spiral of violence is worsening in Israel and the Palestinian territories. Late last week, Israeli soldiers killed 9 Palestinians, injured another 20 in the occupied West Bank town of Jenin. Israel's government says it was an anti-terrorist raid. One victim was an elderly woman bystander. A day later, a Palestinian gunman shot 7 Jewish worshippers outside a synagogue. So is this the start of a third intifada? Dr. Eyal Mayrouz is with the Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Sydney.
The seeds have been planted for a long time, I think, since even the days of the last government. The reality on the ground during the government of Naftali Bennett, which was a mix of right-wing, left-wing, center, and even Palestinians, was that more Palestinians were killed in the West Bank than in the previous decade and a half. So the seeds have already been planted beforehand. What I think is taking place now is an escalation in Israel of attacks against Jews, not as much an escalation of what is taking place against Palestinians in the West Bank.
I see that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister, wants more Israelis. I'm not sure if he only means Jewish Israelis to have access to guns. What's that going to mean?
Well, this is a crazy idea, obviously, because already Israelis carry probably more guns than any other country in the world. But most guns are centered, if you look at a map of where most guns as percentage of the population are being stored or carried, you're seeing the settlement or the settlements, and these are the most radical extremists. So calling on them to carry more guns is pretty much a free license to use them and use them against the law. And this is a call for, again, an escalation and violence breaking out.
To what extent are individuals who are now in positions of great power in Benjamin Netanyahu's government responsible for some of the escalation? Who's this fellow Itamar Ben-Gvir? He's the national security minister. What sort of language does he use?
There's a group of radical elements in Netanyahu's government that he agreed to bring into power in return for trying to escape a jail sentence on charges of corruption that he's currently facing. But these radical elements are certainly a great risk, I would say, both to Jews and Palestinians. And Itamar Ben-Gvir was given the extreme power of a national security minister that everyone is fearing he will use in ways that will certainly contribute to an escalation and possibly even to a third intifada.
Eyal, didn't he, if my reading is correct, have on his wall until a couple of years ago a rather large portrait of Baruch Goldstein, who was the Jewish terrorist who murdered 29 Palestinians and I think injured another 100 Palestinians in a mosque attack back in the 90s?
Yes, he's trying to kind of reinvent himself. He used to be the target of the Israeli security services as a potential troublemaker, and he was indicted for all kinds of incitement to violence and so on. And now the same person was a target of the security forces and the police, is heading these same security forces and the police.
Whose interests would a third intifada serve? Because if we think of the first intifada back in the late 80s, the second in the early 2000s, they didn't achieve a Palestinian state. So whose interests would it serve?
I think this is a very important and difficult to answer question, because on one hand, you see radicals on both sides of the aisle or the camps having or seeing their interest in setting the country aflame, which is, again, an important trigger, a potential trigger for a third intifada. If you look on the Jewish side, then most people have learned to live with, you know, the reality of the status quo. Yes, there are cycles of terrorist attacks, periodic rocket firing from Gaza. But what other better alternatives are there for us? But the real issue is that on the Palestinian side, if you are looking closely, you see a very different picture, because what we see is an increasing sense of hopelessness. And frankly, it is one that is not difficult to understand, because if you take a toll, then they are living under an ongoing occupation. There are no prospects in the near or even mid-term future for a Palestinian state. There's a continued expansion of the Jewish settlements, establishing facts on the ground. There's now, with the new government, increasing fear of annexation of the West Bank. And there's increasing or worsening incidents of humiliation, human rights that they've been subjected to, mainly by the settlers, sometimes by the army. And finally, there is a sense of abandonment by the Arab world that may lead the majority of the population, Palestinian population in the West Bank, who were so far fearing of supporting a third intifada because of the dire consequences, economic consequences and security consequences, may lead them to the desperate act of supporting, you know, such an uprising.
The Palestinians have said that they might withdraw security and intelligence cooperation with the Israelis. A long time ago, you were an intelligence officer in Israel. What would it mean if the Palestinians actually went through with that promise and withdrew all intelligence and security cooperation?
This has happened before more than once. The PA, the Palestinian Authority, was created in 1994 as a transition to Palestinian states, and it's stayed since. It is an authority that doesn't enjoy the support of most of the population in the West Bank. And part of the reason for that is that it has been cooperating on security issue with the Israeli army and Israeli security forces, and in fact have taken upon themselves much of the work that before that the Israeli army had to do. So certainly Israel is very much dependent on security cooperation over time, but from what I'm hearing from some sources, this withholding of security cooperation has already been done, but at a lower level, that there is still some cooperation because Palestinian Authority is still dependent on Israel to a large extent. Whether that will completely fall apart, whether the Palestinian Authority will fall apart, that will certainly be a major blow and will contribute to an escalation of violence.
What if the Palestinians went even one further and said, look, if you want to run the West Bank, because, you know, previous coalition agreements have involved serious talk of actually formally annexing the West Bank, if the Palestinians said, fine, you take over this place, you run the schools, you run the hospitals, we will relinquish the Palestinian Authority, but give us the vote. Give us the vote. Make us citizens of Israel with all the same political rights. What would the response be in Israel to that?
Now you're kind of transitioning to the question of one state solution versus two state solution, which is a very important one, because from my perspective, my understanding is that this situation today with the new Israeli government and the escalation has dealt a death blow to the one-state solution, because the one-state solution was never really, you know, a likely reality, because Israelis, as you kind of alluded to, have never agreed and will never agree to giving 6 million or at least 4 million Palestinians voting rights in a dual nationality country. And so the reason why a lot of Palestinians and a lot of left-wing Israelis support the idea of one-state solution is because it will kind of tear off the mask of the Israeli kind of argument that we want a state that is both democratic and Jewish, because I don't see any possibility of allowing citizenship to the Palestinians, and therefore we are only left with the two-state solution.
What about just finally, Eyal, another scenario that I read about actually in the Jerusalem Post last year, and that is this notion of Yerida, which is the opposite of Aliyah, Yerida being the outward migration of Jews from Israel. What would happen if, I don't know, the 15, 20, 25% of Israeli Jews who said, look, we don't want to buy into any sort of ethno-nationalism, we can, as post-World War II history shows, build very good lives in places like Australia, Canada, the United States. What if they just said, we want to leave en masse? What would that do to Israel?
I think this question of leaving Israel has been on the table a number of times in the past. Each time there was a difficult situation, some have left. And it's certainly today in an unprecedented scale, at least the considerations, because of the new government being dominated by religious, I'd say a lot of religious MPs and Jews that are threatening to undermine the status quo between religious Jews and secular Jews. So there is a great fear among the secular Jews in Israel of an overrun. And that is the case, usually leads to consideration of leaving the country. But I don't think too many Israelis are in a position to, in terms of their not having foreign nationalities or their ability to immigrate or leaving their families or leaving their jobs to do that. So there will be a wave of Yerida, as you say, immigration, but I don't think it will demographically make any change to their realities. What might happen is what they call a brain drain, where a lot or relatively high number of very smart people leaving, which will obviously undermine the economy.
Dr. Eyal Meiruz, he is a senior lecturer in peace and conflict studies at the University of Sydney and an expert in the Middle East. Thank you for coming back to the Religion and Ethics Report, Eyal.
Thank you for inviting me.
And you're with Andrew West on RN and the ABC Listen app. Terrible violence also in Pakistan, where a bomb exploded at a mosque in Peshawar, a city near the border with Afghanistan. This is quite a fast-moving story, but as of Wednesday evening, at least 100 people had died in the explosion. A low-level commander from the Pakistani Taliban has claimed responsibility, although the official Taliban spokesman has denied involvement. An antidote, though, to some of this global violence, Pope Francis has begun a peace-building trip to Africa. He's visiting the Democratic Republic of Congo, where he'll meet survivors of the communal fighting that's gripped the country. He's also making an ecumenical visit to South Sudan, along with the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury and the head of the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. It's Francis's 40th overseas trip as Pope and his fifth visit to Africa, where 20% of the world's Catholics live. One of America's oldest universities is mired in a debate over Islamic art. Hamline University in Minnesota terminated the contract of an adjunct lecturer who displayed two reverent artworks of the Prophet Muhammad. Now, she gave the class four warnings before showing the historic images, but one student raised complaints afterwards. This episode raises questions over academic freedom and also whether images of the prophet can ever be shown. Professor Christian Gruber of the University of Michigan writes about the controversy in the current edition of New Lines magazine.
There are actually two artworks that were shown inside the classroom, and the module in which they were included tackled representations of prophets and notions of the divine in religious art, including Byzantine icons and representations of the Buddha. And so the instructor included, for the purposes of global comparison, two pre-modern paintings of the Prophet Muhammad. Both of them are included in illustrated manuscripts. Those are texts that are handwritten. That also includes paintings inside of them. So they're a little bit like today's graphic novels, if you like.
And they're not caricatures. They're not cartoons. They're quite reverential pieces of art, aren't they?
That's right. They have absolutely nothing to do with today's cartoons from Europe and America. In fact, when you think about the scale of human emotion, they're on the opposite side of the spectrum. You have love and hate, right, on either end of the gamut. Those paintings were made in love of the Prophet and in exaltation of the Quran, whereas the cartoons are done for the purposes of hate or mocking or disrespect. So they're actually on the other side of the spectrum.
Is there a lot of art, Christiane, Islamic art and texts that do depict the Prophet Muhammad?
There are plenty of texts and artworks that either describe or depict the Prophet Muhammad in Islamic lands. Those tend to have been made in Turkish and Iranian geographical spheres, much more so than in Arab lands. And they tend to date from between 1300 to the 19th century, with a dwindling in that practice during the modern period.
And did I read, indeed, in your essay that in Iran, as recently as 20 years ago, so certainly since the revolution, there were postcards, greeting cards that depicted the Prophet Muhammad?
That's right. In fact, when I was doing my research there in 2000, so about 23 years ago, and I've gone back since then, of course, I walked into a supermarket and I wanted to buy some fruits and vegetables. And in the fruit and vegetable section was a greeting card rack. And I went to look because I wanted to write a postcard to my family. And I found several greeting cards with images of not just the Prophet Muhammad, but also of Imam Ali and Imam Hussein as well. And so I didn't think twice about it. I just bought a few cards because I thought they were interesting. And Iranians also, who are, of course, Muslim, many of whom are Shi'i Muslim, didn't think twice about it either. They were using postcards with depictions of the Prophet to greet each other. And it was considered such a common good that you could find it among the fruit and vegetable section in supermarkets.
Don't some of these depictions of Muhammad show him with a halo? Aren't they designed to actually illustrate a very reverential part of the history, Muhammad receiving the word of God or something to that effect?
That's right. There are different kinds of depictions of the Prophet. Sometimes you can see his facial feature, but he has a halo or a flaming aureole. Sometimes his face, however, is covered by a veil. So there are different ways of depicting him. But regardless of whether the facial features are visible or not, the urge has always been, artistically speaking, to elevate him beyond the merely mortal realm. He was only a man. He wasn't considered like Christ by substantial, right? He's not the Son of God. But nevertheless, devotees, so pious Muslim believers, wanted to convey through text and through images his propinquity, his touch by the divine. And some of those strategies included the facial veil to suggest that he's too beautiful and radiant to behold, that he's secreted away in a different realm, and the halo, which suggests that he was touched by the light of God and received enlightenment or illumination through the revelation of the Quran, which is considered, by the way, a light for the believer, so guidance of sorts.
So the professor who displayed these two images very briefly, Professor Erica Lopez Prater, she gave a warning to the class. I think the warning went for almost 2 minutes. It was seemed to be quite respectful. She explained that she was going to display these images, suggested if people were upset, they could leave the class for a period. What then happened?
As far as I can tell, I was not in the classroom, so I'm relying on the written reports that were published in the Oracle, Hamline University's student newspaper. One student is a member of the Muslim community, and she decided to stay in the classroom. We don't know why she opted to remain, because the syllabus mentioned that these images would be shown and that she could reach out with concerns already at the beginning of the semester. the exercise was optional. She had the option to close her screen or turn away from the online class, but nevertheless, she decided to look on. And I can't assign any volition to her acts. Safe to say that she found those images disrespectful and inauthentic, and then asked for something to be done at the administrative level. It could be that there are incidents on campus that were Islamophobic that had accumulated over time that perhaps administrators had not tackled properly. And maybe to her mind, this was the last straw that broke the camel's back.
Well, I did notice that Professor Omid Safi, who is a professor of Middle Eastern studies at Duke University, he said he regularly shows images of the Prophet Muhammad in class, and he does not give any warnings. He does not say that the students can leave the classroom. He seemed to have had no problems. So, I mean, in this particular case at Hamline University, what do you think, or what do you worry is the greater principle at stake here?
Well, before I answer that question, let me say that in line with Omid Safi, I teach these images of Muhammad regularly. And in fact, I teach a full PhD seminar, which lasts an entire semester, on Islamic images of the Prophet Muhammad. So I've trained PhD students in this material, and I never include trigger warnings or content warnings or the option to bow out. And a number of my PhD students are Muslims, and they've become specialists in the subject. So that's the first thing I think is worthwhile mentioning. The second point that you make is what is at stake. I've heard a lot about academic freedom and freedom of speech, and indeed, those issues are at stake. And the clamping down of particular materials does send a chilling effect to all faculty, but especially those who are contingent and don't have the protections of tenure. For me, though, as an Islamic art historian, what is at stake is that what I'm seeing here is essentially a persecution of historical materials, an attack on artworks. And artworks don't have a voice, unlike human beings, so they can't speak back when you accuse them of, say, hate speech, especially if that's not their intent, if an object could have an intent at all. So I worry about this instance as being an attack on cultural heritage, an attack on non-Western art, which already has struggled to find a spot at the table within the field of art history in general. So it's doing damage to actors of the past who happen to have been Muslim, and it's potentially endangering Islamic art, both in reality as objects that need to be preserved and as a scholarly discipline that needs to grow in academic settings.
Christiana, hasn't Hamline University, though, wound back or retracted, I think, at least one of the criticisms it made of the part-time art professor whose contract is still terminated? I think they no longer accuse this professor of Islamophobia. Is that right?
That's correct. About an hour before the lawsuit became national news, and certainly the administrators already had notification of this lawsuit, the chair of the board of trustees, along with the president, wrote a statement. And the only accusation that they slightly walked back was the accusation of Islamophobia, and it dovetailed with the lawsuit. That could have legal implications in terms of how this plays out in a court of law. However, they didn't retract any of the other accusations. They didn't offer a public apology. So they still have not admitted to any wrong, and they haven't offered a simple "we're sorry" to the professor in question.
It is hard to maintain the argument that it's Islamophobic when an executive of the Council of American Islamic Relations has said, look, the picture might be un-Islamic, but it's not Islamophobic.
That's correct. It's impossible to claim that these paintings are Islamophobic when, in fact, at the very core, they're Islamophilic. And that's why we have to really backtrack and rewind and be historically accurate and sensitive to actors of the past. Now, the CARE representative also said that they're not Islamophobic, but un-Islamic. And I would counter argue that they are, in fact, Islamic. They were made by Muslim artists for Muslim patrons in honor of the Prophet and the Quran. And that constitutes Islamic. So we could get into a very long theological debate on what constitutes Islamic or not. But I am of the very firm belief that these materials are key components of the arts of the lands of Islam, and they need to be treated as such. And that means transgressing and surpassing our own anachronistic expectations of what constitutes Islam. Islam is not just a religious faith that bans or destroys images. That has not been historically the case, and we need to treat materials in a historically accurate way.
Just finally, Christiane, you mentioned sensitivity there. How do we be sensitive, though, to the students at Hamline? Their argument is, look, we are part of a minority within a minority. We're black students, we're Muslim students, there is an series of Islamophobic incidents in our city. You know, we thought this was just one more layer and it maybe was the final straw. I mean, is there an argument for some sensitivity there?
Sure. And I agree. This community in Minnesota has been the target of violent Islamophobic attacks, including attacks on mosques. And there have been instances, as far as I can tell, on campus. And students had complained beforehand. They even asked for halal food in the cafeteria, and it took about a year for the administration to take action on that front. We do have to be mindful of the fact that certain minorities are the target of bias and violence. And two of my colleagues have written about the role of blackness in this incident, which we have to take seriously. This said, we have to be careful to split and not lump evidence. And what I mean by that is that we can't lump historical Islamic paintings with an instance of attacking a mosque. These are two unlikes, and it's very important to help the students understand that one should not engage in those kinds of cognitive elisions. And that's part of the education process. So administrators and teachers at the university should have basically slowed down, brought the student together, maybe with the teacher or with a series of teachers and administrators, hosted a conversation rather than shutting it down, and use this moment as a teachable one and not an impeachable one. That's part of the educational mandate of the university, and that requires sensitivity to everyone and not just one particular group of individuals, because sensitivity also has to be extended to faculty members who are humans with just more years on them and more scars on their body than their students. And they happen to be also just as vulnerable, if not more vulnerable, if they're contingent faculty members. What would behoove us here is to really slow down and take a 360-degree approach to the issue and understand that there are very legitimate grievances that need to be addressed, but these are not one and the same as a devotional painting of the Prophet Muhammad from Iran that was made in 1300.
Christiane Gruber is Professor of Islamic Art at the University of Michigan. She's the author of a fascinating article in New Lines magazine over this controversy at Hamline University. Christiane, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much for having invited me.
And that's the show for today. You can find us at the ABC Listen app. Although if you do subscribe to us on other platforms, such as Apple Podcasts, you may have to go back and resubscribe because we now come through only as separate stories, not as the whole program. And if you do like the program, you can give us a review on those platforms as well. Thanks this week to Hong Zhang and Hamish Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.